Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. On October 20th, 2025, I connected with Cindy Schweik-Handler and Harry Handler on Zoom to talk about their biography, A German Jew's Triumph, Fritz Oppenheimer and the Denazification of Germany. It was published by McFarland & Company in April 2025. I want to start this interview with a question for Harry. Can you tell us about the moment that you discovered your grandfather's letters and documents stuffed in a closet? What made you realize that this story needed to be told?
Well, first of all, we're very fortunate to find the documents. You know, I grew up in central Illinois, kind of knew my mother was German, but had no sense of the past. Nobody ever spoke about it, neither did my grandmother. She passed away in 1993. We were going to throw out everything in her apartment, decided to put them in a closet here in Montclair, New Jersey. They sat for another 10 years. A kid was working on a middle school project and said, I'm doing something about the Marshall Plan. I thought, oh, your grandfather worked for the State Department. Maybe there's something in there, and opened up these documents for the first time and found Hitler's last political will and testament, and found things signed by Hitler that were clearly from Hitler's bunker and from the Gestapo headquarters in Berlin. Thought, wow, what's the story here? I read an account of the surrender, and then I went back and looked at the newsreels of the surrender in World War II and could see, you know, look, there's Grandpa, there's Fritz Oppenheimer in front of the Nazis, you know, taking the surrender in Berlin. And I said, boy, there is a story here, and then went to tell it. Fortunately, you know, we came across the documents that was probably in the early 2000s, but the letters we only came across after my mother passed away. So that was, you know, 2016, 2017. We came across the letters.
As a follow-up, Cindy, you're a journalist and you've written for the New York Times and the Washington Post. What was it about Fritz's story that made you think, well, this is bookworthy?
Harry had actually taken his documents to a professor he knew who had written several history books and said, I think you should write this up as a book. And the professor said to Harry, I think you should write this up as a book. And then Harry came to me and I was in the middle of doing something. I was just kind of thinking my way through. And he said, I think you should write it. At first I thought, well, I don't know. Tell me more about it. And when he described it to me as a kind of unusual story of justice served. Here was somebody who everything had been taken away from him, but he had a massive sense of agency and went and figured out what he could do to restore justice as he saw it. I thought that's very satisfying for me. As you know, there are so many stories from World War II who are incredibly compelling, but they don't end as satisfactorily as we would like because there wasn't much people could do. And he was somebody who was, you know, a German, an international lawyer, was well-versed in a half dozen languages. And he was really perfect for that point in history to make a difference.
Well, it's a really fascinating story, and you guys must have had quite the adventure capturing this person and trying to put him on the page. And I want to dive into the character arc of Oppenheimer for a second. Can you paint a picture of who he was before the Nazis came to power? Like, what was life like as a wealthy Jewish banker in Berlin?
Especially leading up to World War I, it was fine time to be Jewish in Germany, you know, at the time. They were part of a fairly aristocratic German family of bankers and silversmiths, and his father was a lawyer who worked for major banks. So they had a very pleasant life in Berlin. You know, he went to French school and learned, you know, Greek and Latin. You know, he was very patriotic to Germany. You know, this story didn't really come out till later because he had to hide his origins once he came to the United States. But, you know, he volunteered for the German army as soon as he could in World War I. First battle is Verdun, won two Iron Crosses, was fighting up to the very end. He won a second Iron Cross right before the armistice. So, you know, he was an interesting character, and he always wanted to prove himself. I think he wanted to be at the center of history, and he put himself there. I will say, I think there's Part of his personality came from being 5'3". He was one of five children in 3 years, so there were two sets of twins, and he was exactly in the middle. He's the middle twin, so I think that also you kind of want to make a difference when you come from a family like that.
Absolutely. And then in mid-1938, he fled Germany. But then he joined the US Army, like basic training, when he was 45 years old. What drove him to make this choice? Like, what's that about?
From the minute he came over to America, his family had gotten out before him. He represented a number of American companies and the American Chamber of Commerce. So he was lucky they got out. He joined them. I think first they were in England, right? He left a few months before Kristallnacht, right? That was July 1938. They were in England, and then the family went ahead of him in 1940. And from the minute he got to America, they weren't in the war effort yet, but he wanted to combat the Nazis. And he was involved in some government programs helping immigrants in Washington, but it wasn't satisfying to him. And he kept trying to join the army, and he was too old. And it was finally in 43, I think, where they raised the age to 45, where he could get in. And they said, if you're going to join the army, you have to go through basic training like everybody else. He said, that's not going to stop me. And of course, everybody was twice his size and half his age, but he was pretty tough.
Yeah, I mean, just as a side note, this man would just be like, I'm gonna go climb a mountain. And he would, like, he made such risky choices with his body. I mean, he was injured in World War I. And then, as a way to cope with maybe his trauma, right? He was a very athletic figure. So, I mean, he was old.
It was very important for him to be at the center of the action. I think you're right that there was trauma, probably PTSD from World War I. He was constantly in combat as a teenager, having his head knocked around for 3.5 years. He liked hiking before, but I think he needed to live at that sense of danger, probably to combat the PTSD. Joining the army in this country, you have to remember that Germans were enemy aliens, at the time in the United States, because we were at war with Germany and he couldn't really get rid of his accent. So there was a real question about even would the Germans be interned, like we did to the Japanese, or could he go into the army? So he was very excited to be in the army. He was partially blind in an eye from a World War I injury. At D-Day he would have been just as happy on storming the beaches as he would be working for General Eisenhower at headquarters.
He became General Eisenhower's legal aide and translator. He was tasked with building a sustainable post-war democracy in Germany. So, how did this unique position as both insider and outsider shape his approach to denazification?
It's very interesting to see as he went into post-war Germany. One, he had the skills because he was a German lawyer. So they really kind of needed somebody with a knowledge of German law to do it. He had to keep his origin secret. He felt that everybody felt that the Germans would not want to have a German Jew helping, come up with the laws. But you also wonder how in a thoroughly Nazified Germany did they come up with a independent judiciary? And in many cases, honestly, he went to people he knew. He was a good believer in that there were good Germans. There were people who were not Nazified. His wife's cousin became the minister president. His law professor became the minister of justice. So he went and found people who he knew to help administer the courts.
Which, by the way, was just incredible. The amount of people he knew, how connected he was. I mean, that really saved his life.
What I always say is, like, he wanted to be in the room where it happened. I mean, all the time, everywhere. When he was in Germany, when he was in America. And I think he had worked in the 30s, right, with John McCloy, who became the Assistant Secretary of War. Richard Wilberforce, the center thing, they climbed Westminster Abbey together drunkenly in the middle of the night. And he really had this huge personality. He always felt like those connections are critical. And, he was really committed to making a difference and, doing what he could.
Kind of a real life Forrest Gump in a way. I mean, that's me being glib,
But honestly,
No. You know, there was a Woody Allen movie about this guy who was everywhere all the time. And
oh.
a lot of people have said that to us, that he's like, you know, that sounds more European too. For 3.5 years, he was in almost all the major battles in World War I. We couldn't believe it. And he had kept diaries. So, you know, that was an interesting thing that we had a PhD student translate the World War I diaries, and we got back 150 single-spaced pages, you know, accounting every battle he was in, with even like longitudinal and latitudinal coordinates. And sometimes, like, oh, the name of this town was changed to something, but he checked and everything happened as Fritz recorded. But here he was, like, recording these things in these tiny diaries at night after these major battles. So he did have a sense that he's somebody who should be, you know, somebody should be keeping track of his exploits, and that became his wife afterwards.
Also think he was a good soldier. You know, they promoted him up to, you know, Jews could not be promoted in the German army, so he, you know, didn't become a commissioned officer, but he became a master sergeant. And I think other members of his family who are not probably as good soldiers, you know, people didn't always get promoted up that way, but he was seemed very courageous, did not mind going to the front. That's why I think he ended up in all these major battles.
Well, I kind of want to pivot into this language barrier for a second, since Cindy brought it up about this professor that you guys worked with for translation purposes. Fritz was, of course, multilingual. He worked across cultures. So, how did you guys handle the documents and correspondence in multiple languages?
The difficult thing is neither one of us speaks German, unfortunately. We don't speak anything else for like a little French. But we were fortunate that the volumes of letters that we had, you know, because Fritz's wife, Elspeth, kept everything. He didn't keep anything that she wrote, but she kept everything. I mean, hundreds of letters. And the minute they left Germany, they spoke English. Like, they just, you know, from like 1938 on or whatever, they were just writing letters in English. So that was good. For German, his World War I diaries, which were really extensive, you know, we had this professor translate it. You know, we went to the archives in America and in London, and that was easy. But the Bundesarchives in Germany, they have some things online, but it was difficult. So we actually got somebody who was a TA at a university who was back in Berlin for the co for COVID, right? And he looked up things that were very helpful too, and return them to us.
I will say, because I transcribed hundreds of these letters, that beautiful but impenetrable German script, cursive script, you know, which I used to make my mother type her letters to me because I couldn't read her handwriting. You know, that's the way that Fritz Oppenheimer wrote too. So after a while, as a historian, you just need to learn to look at that script, and after a while, you figure it out. It's like a puzzle, but took a while, but figured it out.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that research process then. What was it like to follow Fritz Oppenheimer's footsteps? To what extent did you guys do that? What were some of the more interesting things that you learned in the archives, or what were some of the most surprising things in the documents that you uncovered?
We did follow in Fritz Oppenheimer's footsteps. We went from Berlin, you know, through northern France and Reims and Paris. Fortunately, he fought east to west in World War I and then west to east in the exact same places. So we do it at a different time. But it was very interesting to see the battlefields and the surrender museums personally to get in there. I'll let Cindy talk about the archives because we found all sorts of wonderful things there. The thing that was most meaningful to me, I think, in one of the denazification or the archives about denazification, we did find the Nuremberg Laws, which had taken away the rights of, you know, Jews in Germany. And you got to see his handwriting on the laws, rewriting how we would change the laws. So these laws took away his rights, and then Fritz Oppenheimer got to help rewrite those laws. So to me, that was the most meaningful thing we found that I found in the archives. But Cindy's got some great
Yeah.
stories as
Well, we're
well.
lucky with our subject matter. I mean, it was really nice. Like, Harry went online and arranged to have the first thing we did, I think, there was a woman online who could give tours of World War I battlefields. And we outlined where we wanted to go. And, you know, so we went to Verdun and we got to tour for Douaumont, where Fritz was, I think it was February of 1917.
Yeah, it was actually May 16th.
16. Like, I think it was the first battle he was engaged in, and the first thing he did, he had to, because he was so small and fast and wiry, they had him have to lay down communications wire off of a spool. Sometimes you see it in movies, and then just like run along the ground through all the battle, for miles and get up to the destination. And Fort Douaumont was one of six forts, I think, maybe in that area. And it kept changing hands back and forth. And the Germans were there at that time, but the French were attacking it. And it was just, it was horrific. And some soldiers, the belief is, were inside of the fort, which was considered physically kind of a refuge. And their lit cigarettes set off all these this artillery and a series of explosions, and something like, I think it's kind of confirmed now, 680 or something soldiers died. And Fritz was on a very high floor, so he got out of it. But just there was no substitute for seeing it. It was really great to see that setting. And they had the beds where the soldiers were. You could see exactly where he was lying and what he had to endure to get out of there. Then there are other things that you can do online that these days are great. You can find through description the exact box in the National Archives that you want to look in. In our case, it was SHAE, for the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force. They kept the records at College Park in Maryland. He was in G5, and you could find out, the people who were in charge of Germany, what country group that was. Just go there and look it up. And that was amazing. And then, yeah, there were other things like just digging. Like, I found it was one of my favorite stories. There was a chat group who followed Royal British Navy history. I started talking to these men, and I said what I was looking for information about the convoy that Harry's mother was on with her brother and Harry's grandmother, and it was torpedoed, and they almost sank, but they didn't. But boats all around them sank, and it was very traumatizing to her. And this one gentleman on the chat said, "Well, I'm sure you've seen a roster of the." The passengers on the boat. And I was like, no, I haven't actually. And he shared, the name, the origin of everybody on the boat, what they went through, the questions that were asked of them before they could disembark. And it was just fascinating. So just keeping on going online was really very helpful.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. I want to talk about the writing process for a second. First of all, you guys collaborated on this thing and you're still married.
Yeah.
That's
So, what was that like?
You're not the first person to say that, but the way we tended to do it was, Harry had a lot of research and resources downstairs in our house. And of course, he knows the story really well. And I would be writing, and any questions that I had, and there were a lot of them, I would just text him. And then he kind of had the library downstairs, and he would help with answers. And that's kind of how it worked out. And sometimes I would say, well, here's a resource we should get. And even like the interlibrary system can be great, and he'd have it downstairs. Or we go into the city, the Leo Beck Institute was very helpful. We're in Montclair, New Jersey. It's right outside the city. And so we would make those trips together.
I will say our talents are complementary on this. Love the history and I love finding the story. Less good at writing it. So wrote it once, really was not very good. Cindy's an excellent writer and been a journalist for many years. So she just took it and we redid it again. So we have very complementary skills and that worked out for creating what I think was a good book.
I agree. It's really well written. It's written in present tense, which kind of gives this urgency to it. It's beautifully written. It's compelling. It's a page turner. How did you capture Fritz?
Well, there's a few things that I've thought about doing this. And we recently spoke to a university group on writing historical biographies. And we did it chronologically, more or less. So that's, kind of as we're moving forward in time, sometimes it can be hard to know how much a historical background to put in, because you have to understand the choices that Fritz made. You have to know, of course, what was going on around him. So my rule of thumb for myself was never have more than two or three paragraphs without tying it back to him somehow. Like, you just can't wander off the reservation. It just has to, it's about him. Whatever you have, then you can go away again, but it always has to be tied back to his story and what he wants to do. The rest of it was just like, I've written some fiction, just a little bit, and taken fiction writing classes. And I think that with all writing, you want to be thinking, what will the reader want to be seeing? What will they want to know about what the character is thinking? What does it look like, out there? What does it smell like? What are the sounds going? But just as much as you can bring the scene alive as possible. And there were a lot of things that lent themselves, a lot of settings that were, you knew you were going to build out as scenes, like, the convoy being torpedoed, or Fritz climbing up Westminster Abbey, or in Fort Douaumont. There are other things we had less information for, so, but you want to get it out there because the reader needs to know it. But I think it's just like the same skills that in any kind of writing. It's like, what does the reader need to know? What would the reader want to know?
We're also, I'd say we're quite fortunate that when he wrote the letters too, he also described his feelings. He would talk about, when he was in World War I and he wanted to, now he wasn't so courageous anymore. He was petrified. He'd sacrifice a leg to get out of here. He described going down into Hitler's bunker. So, it was very fortunate. We didn't have to make too many leaps. He would describe what he was thinking and feeling as he went through. So Cindy did a marvelous job of putting it into present tense and keeping the reader attached in the story. But it was also nice that we he didn't have to go very far afield because he really wrote down what he was thinking and seeing.
Right. And I should say that we were very lucky that his writing was so good, and his wife's was pretty good too, actually. Yeah, very evocative. And he wrote down everything, and she recorded everything. I mean, even after they separated,
That's a gold mine for a biographer. Harry, how has researching and telling your grandfather's story changed your understanding of him and maybe of yourself?
The stories about him you kind of heard through, his wife, his daughter. Not a great family man, but a very compelling personality. And I remember when I was 13, I came to New York. My grandmother and I attended a lecture by John McCloy, who was head of the World Bank. I'm not sure what role he had at the time, but he had many roles. And he went up and I met him. And he said, "Oh, I knew your grandfather. He was a great man. I wanted to know, more about him." And, this was really a treasure trove because you get to read what he was, thinking as, went through, and then to hear the parts of, history. I did learn a couple of surprises there, too. I would have thought that Nazis come to power in 1933, they're of Jewish origin, that they, like Anne Frank's family, would get out of there. Turns out they weren't fighting to leave, they were fighting to stay. That was a surprise. His whole World War I record was a surprise because he had to keep it secret while he was in this country. It didn't help his career at the time. So, that was all brand new to us. So, a lot of surprises along the journey, but that's the excitement of history.
Well, for our audience, what advice would you give somebody who's discovered a family story that they think might be worth telling?
The first thing is talk to other people about it and see what their reaction is. I mean, just really read their faces and their responses. Because we found when we described it as a, I think he had one letter that he said described having the top Nazis surrender to him and to helping to write the surrender in Germany, which he did. He called it a miraculously fine assignment. So that was like the working title for a while that we had that. But when we would describe it to people as a really rare reversal of fortune, or just like this turnabout, like justice served in an unusual way, people will get excited about it. So you just try that out. Just try, almost like kind of pitching it to your friends and the people like, you have the story, and then look at their reaction and see what it is. Maybe do a little bit of research, because especially from this era, which I was always so interested in World War II, I felt like there's nothing closer to like black and white, right and wrong that we know of there. And there are a lot of compelling stories out there. You know, try it out, see what happens.
So, Cindy, you mentioned that this story resonates powerfully in our own time of trouble, right? How do you see Fritz's story speaking to our current moment?
I feel that he contributed a lot to history and the last 80 years of democracy in the Western world, in that, you know, denazification was very controversial. And, you know, there was a feeling like, well, you know, Nazis, they need to be punished, like collectively or whatever. And my impression of what they arrived at finally, and he wrote Law 104, it's kind of obscure, but it was the law that allowed the Americans to leave and for Germans to assess their own people's sense of guilt. And I think what they said was that you will be judged by the crime you committed. You know, if you murdered somebody, you're going to be punished for murdering somebody. If you an arsonist is going to be punished as an arsonist. And it wasn't like, you know, you're also a member of the Nazi Party and that adds a lot to your criminal background. Kind of in the same way that in Iraq, you know, they said, well, if you're a Ba'athist, you know, you're going to pay. And then they eliminated everybody from society was incapable of getting that country going again. And so it was impartial justice. And I think that you see now in a lot of places around the world, and you're seeing it here, where justice is not meted out impartially. That's the scariest thing for me, because you know, you could say like there's an authoritarian playbook. We're seeing a lot of those same actions being taken now. But to me, if two people commit the same crime and one is on one side and it's absolutely fine, and on the other side you're going to be persecuted or whatever, or have to pay the price, you're going down a very bad road. And when we first started this, you know, I think it was 2017 when we went on that trip to Europe, we thought, oh, I wonder if this is going to be as relevant, you know, and it's just gotten more so. When we talked to audiences, we're really concerned. So, you know, it's just good. We said it's good to have a plan B, you know, like as Fritz did, to just have thoughts about what you would do if your country became authoritarian, but also what role can you play? What can you do while it's still possible? Just have your eyes open.
I mean, his story really does tell us what one person can do and the difference that one person can make,
Right.
really.
Right, absolutely.
Well, thank you both so much. That was Cindy Schweikhandler and Harry Handler talking with me about their book, A German Jew's Triumph: Fritz Oppenheimer and the Denazification of Germany, which was published by McFarland and Company in April 2025. This interview was recorded on Zoom on October 20th, 2025. To learn more about BIO or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm BIO member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Sonia Williams is our executive producer. Darren Nesblid created our theme music. Until next time, thanks so much for listening.